You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights, down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're here with Annie, Tobiah and Anila on Solidarity Breakfast. How are you guys going this morning?
All right. I think we're all a little bit rattled. One's trying to finish all his assignments. One's been out drinking and... And,
You're not supposed to tell them that, Annie.
Together we form the Voltron head of making this show run today.
Yes, that's right. And thank you very much for some of the people who've contributed information about stuff that's going on out there in the big world. One of the things that people might have slipped past people's attention is that the Victorian government completely lost the plot. It would appear that not only are they wanting to put all children 14 and above committing violent crimes into detention indefinitely, but also that they want to resurrect the zombie legislation around quelling dissent. There's going to be a snap rally on Tuesday, the anti-protest laws rally, Tuesday the 18th of November, 5:30 p.m. Parliament steps, called by the Defend Dissent Coalition. As Friends of the Earth have put out a release saying the laws have been condemned by human rights organisations, multicultural organisations, trade unions and more for threatening our right to freely assemble and participate in peaceful protest, the cornerstone of our democracy. The restrictions on face masks threaten the immune compromised and others who have very legitimate reasons to wear a mask at protests. To get a medical exemption, you would need to produce a proof of medical status when asked by the police, which could lead to the targeting of people with disabilities and dissuade them from attending protests. Similarly, many people wear masks to protect their anonymity, to stop being targeted by far-right groups, or to prevent being identified by perpetrators of family violence, employers, family members, or people in their community who could retaliate for their participation in protests, not to mention to protect from police indiscriminate use of capsicum spray, as we've seen of late. Also, under the new laws, those using attachment devices could face a year in jail. Protesters have long used glues, ropes and locks in ways that do not pose a danger to the police, to the public. In fact, attachment devices have been an integral part of community strategies to save forests, stop gas drilling, secure workers' rights and more. The laws could put those people in jail for a year. Shocking. Proposed laws in Western Australia and laws introduced in Queensland enabling police to target activists possessing devices that could be used to lock on have previously been criticised by four UN special rapporteurs as punishing expression protected by international human rights laws. So the merry maids at Victorian Parliament are on the march, and part of it is the Human Rights Law Centre condemns the Allan government for proposing children as young as 14 be locked away for life in Victoria.
And on a platform that's eerily reminiscent of what the Queensland Liberal government ran on, which is adult crime, adult time.
Yeah, that's right. This is from the press release that the Victorian government put out, all children 14 and above committing violent crimes, like invading someone's home or injuring someone with a machete in a sickening act of violence, will face adult sentences in adult courts under adult time for violent crime. That means courts will treat these children like adults, so jail is more likely and sentences are longer. I've got to tell you what she said, though.
Sorry,
I mean, this is what they, this is from their release. Premier Jacinta Allen joined Attorney General Sonia Kilkenny today to announce that the Allen government, Labor government, will implement it in Victoria with a bill to the, be introduced in Parliament this year. Adult time for violent crime will deliver serious consequences for children committing brazen violent crimes that hurt victims and the community.
I think for me it just makes me question what is the kind of intention behind this type of bill, because we know that the more jail time that children face, the more time in institutions that children face, the more likely they are to reoffend. So this isn't actually
Children?
Yes, also their children. clearly the human rights implications are shocking enough, but even from kind of a pragmatic perspective, thinking about creating safer communities, this is not going to do that. And so I think I personally find it particularly kind of disgusting to think that this is essentially a PR campaign that's jeopardising the futures of clearly vulnerable children.
Yeah, the Human Rights Centre put out its release. It said that the shameful laws will also exacerbate the state's mass imprisonment crisis and the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children being pipelined into prisons. These proposed laws come after the Allen government recently announced they would open the decommissioned Malesborough Youth Prison to lock away more children and defund services that provide invaluable support to children in the community. Children deserve care, not cages and adult prison sentences. The Allen government's proposed laws will condemn children as young as 14 to irreversible harm and an incredibly bleak future behind bars. It's interesting because...
I just think it should be called child abuse.
Yeah. Well,
that is what it is.
Well, it's interesting because I covered a film. I can't remember the name of the film, but it was about... it was a documentary following the work of a program that opened up artistic expression to male prisoners in Victoria, right? And a lot of it was directed to Aboriginal people, older men who were in these prisons. And one of the things that came out in this film was that when these guys came out of prison, they then had a new way of making a living. But the other thing that came out in the film was that all of them had been young boys who had been targeted at a very early age and had ended up in Dramana and places of that nature. And so by that point, their lives were irreversibly changed. And the point about leaving with a skill, allowing them to make a living, it just changed their entire but the thing that really got me was the fact that they were targeted as naughty boys. They were naughty boys. And how is it possible that a whole group of a whole generation is lost because of a racist community? We're fundamentally racist.
And a community that doesn't make enough provisions for children that aren't getting their needs and support needs met at home. Like no one is committing violent crimes without a broader context of distress going on.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, we all know that when a kid makes a really big noise, adults always think that giving them a clip over the ears, not every adult, is going to do the trick.
I'm sorry, we should get back to proper headlines, but I think this is too insane not to mention. On this topic, I was in the car the other day and a mainstream or commercial radio station came on and there was someone on the line saying, you know, the reason that violent crime is on the increase is because we don't use corporal punishment anymore. Back in my day, we had the strap. You got smacked if you did the wrong thing.
And there's nothing wrong with me.
Crimes. Yeah, look at me.
Look at me. Look at me. Look at me.
And I don't know why people haven't figured out yet that being violent towards children does not make them more likely to lead peaceful lives.
Yeah, exactly. Shocking.
Well, you won't hear any of those remarks on community radio because you are on 3CR and we don't encourage corporal punishment.
We certainly do not. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
I'd just like to read just the most recent Al Jazeera little recap. I'll just read the first little paragraph about the Israel's ceasefire violations. 1 month into the declaration of a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, Israel has violated the agreement with near daily attacks, killing hundreds of people. Israel violated the ceasefire agreement at least 282 times from October 10th to November 10th through the continuation of attacks by air, artillery, direct shootings, and direct shootings, the government media office in Gaza reports. The office said that Israel shot at civilians 88 times, raided residential areas beyond the yellow line 12 times, bombed Gaza 124 times, and demolished people's properties on 52 occasions. It added that Israel also detained 23 Palestinians from Gaza over the past month. This is as they negotiate 200 Hamas fighters that are trapped behind the yellow line, and with Israel refusing to guarantee them any sort of safe exit, and continuing demolishing any type of building that's behind the yellow line, saying that Israel's well within its rights to do whatever it wants with that land that it occupies now.
And the other bit of news in the Middle East that I think is worth mentioning is that the UN Human Rights Office reported on Thursday that Israel has killed at least 114 Lebanese civilians since the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon began in November of 2024. So they're also breaching the terms of that ceasefire agreement.
Yeah, well, there's no ceasefire. Yeah, I mean, it's an ersatz ceasefire. I want to move to the cultural survival and COP30. You may, if you've been tuned to Instagram, have seen some amazing pictures of Amazonian Indians in full regalia gate crashing one of the meetings at COP30. The indigenous peoples of the world are banding together and have got a clear message around what they expect to come from COP30. Cultural Survival put out a list of the things that they consider to be a top of the list for the inclusion of indigenous perspectives, as well as the saving of the planet being the priority of any meeting about so-called climate. They demand finance, justice and direct access to climate finance by Indigenous communities, end of sacrifice zones by dismantling the system of environmental racist sacrifice zones created by extractive projects and infrastructure corridors. No community should bear the cost of green, in inverted commas, transitions that reproduce historical injustices, dispossession and contamination in the name of just transition of or green economy. Free, prior and informed consent in all matters related to Indigenous peoples, including policies, investments and extractive industries, and so-called consent given or withdrawn, or so-called development projects from cradle to grave. Communities must be consulted and consent given or withdrawn. End to false solutions such as carbon markets, offsetting and debt-inducing climate finance. Protection of Indigenous peoples in voluntary isolation and initial contact, territorial protection and demarcation of Indigenous lands and territories. A just transition rooted in Indigenous peoples' rights. Precise and systematic integration of Indigenous knowledge systems in all climate policies, national determined contributions and national adaptation plans, direct participation in the design and oversight of transition mineral supply chains, respect and inclusion of Indigenous leadership and knowledge from youth and elders through knowledge exchange investments and youth and elders funds, systems for digital sovereignty, more effective protection of environmental Indigenous rights defenders. I think that's made it fairly clear what they expect from COP30.
Mm-hmm. You know, on environmental news, we've also had some positive news this week. For a little while, we've been covering Monash University's involvement with Woodside Energy. And this week it was announced that the university has cut ties or is planning to cut ties with Woodside Energy following the successful campaign of Stop Woodside Monash, who we were lucky enough to have a chat to on the show. And they've passed on a statement that they'd like us to read out. They've said, we don't yet know the details of this announcement, but this isn't the end of our campaign. We will continue to campaign for a Monash free of fossil fuels and weapons, including total divestment from all fossil fuels and a decent environment, social and governance policy. This win comes as the Monash Vice-Chancellor and Chancellor today at 3 p.m. face questioning in the Federal Senate inquiry into university governance, to which Stop Woodside Monash made a submission earlier this year. We are grateful for the endless support from the Monash Student Association and the Monash branch of the National Tertiary Education Union. These representative organisations have been staunch allies in this campaign. To the many staff and students who have attended our events and rallies, signed petitions, shared our content and helped hold Monash accountable for the harm that Woodside Energy causes, this campaign wouldn't exist without you. However, the fight is not over. Monash is currently seeking to abolish the Monash Sustainable Development Institute, MSDI, and fossil fuel influence is still prevalent at our university and in many others. Woodside continues to destroy country, climate and community in and beyond Pilbara. We stand in solidarity with the Save Our Song lines and the custodians of the lands Woodside continues to exploit in the name of profit. Moments like this prove that organising works. Grassroots campaigns and people power create hope in the face of the climate crisis, and we're overjoyed, to have made a small part of that history today.
I think we should go to a CSA.
Avanti, pop. 3CR, your station, your voice.
These weapons are pointed at all of us. Take it personally.
And we need to be standing with communities on the front lines and really amplifying their fight and their voices.
And fight this until Australia is no longer one of the leading weapons manufacturers.
3CR, your station, your voice.
The band X, the Aussie punk band X, with their song Suck Suck, telling you how to succeed in today's world. I mean, they were talking about it today's world in the 80s, but it's the same neoliberal world that we're living in. It's just the horizons have shrunk, so we need to imagine a world beyond this. We're going to go to our Voices for Palestine segment at the moment, and we'll hear Rabia El Sultan, who's a lawyer, speak about courage. This audio is supplied by Vivian Langford, who you can catch on the Climate Action Show 5 p.m. on Mondays. We always thank Vivian for her amazing contributions and the work she does so tirelessly.
And just to remind people that the rallies for Palestine have gone back to once a month, and the next month's one is on the 7th of December.
Recognition and two-state state solutions are not the solutions. Solutions involve justice and equality for Palestinians. It involves equality in economic and military power and in territorial control. It involves an end to the occupation, an end to the air, land and sea blockade in Gaza, an end to the apartheid. Do not fool us with your deceptive solutions. We want real justice, the right of return for all Palestinians, the right to self-determination. A dear friend of mine, Dr. Hanawi from the West Bank, she's a clinical psychologist, she wrote to me, and I wanted to share something with you. In light of the ceasefire, which has since had at least 100 Palestinians die after, she says, in Palestine, we are in emergency all the time. There is no after the crisis. The crisis is the air we breathe. Every day, humanitarian and healthcare workers operate under bombardment, displacement, and loss. They comfort others while mourning their own families. They offer safety when none exists, and they continue to serve amid fear and exhaustion. They are not only responders, they are wounded healers. For us, healing is not a side project. It is an act of resistance, a form of steadfastness, sumud, that keeps our humanity alive. But most global frameworks for staff care were designed for those who leave the field when the mission ends. But in Palestine, the mission never ends. There was and is no evacuation, no safe zone, no pause. These are the words of a clinical psychologist in the West Bank. And so for all of us here in Australia and around the world, there should be no pause in our efforts. Where are our protesters? There is no comfort until there is a free Palestine. We must learn sumud. We must learn hope. Palestinians, through unimaginable pain, have taught the world the kind of hope that does not ignore injustice, but confronts it. It is a hope that does not require evidence, but it only requires courage. And so we cannot give up. We must continue to call our government to sanction Israel, to end the occupation, and to end the siege. Allow uninterrupted aid into Gaza immediately to protect those who stand for justice, to stop arming Israel. Our Premier, Chris Minns, is hosting and sponsoring a weapons expo, the Indo-Pacific 2025 Summit. Raphael and many other weapons corps. Our state, New South Wales, is hosting war criminals using our money. This must stop. Keep boycotting, keep protesting, keep disrupting and showing up, keep donating. Hope cannot just be a sentiment, it must be a practice. It is a discipline, a legacy. It is what turns mourning into meaning, loss into memory, and destruction into determination. And doing so becomes the foundation for liberation itself. Palestinians are not only victims of a genocide, they are architects, teachers of what resilience actually is. And they are carriers of a hope that endures through every attempt to extinguish it, and we have a role to play to continue that fight until we see a free, liberated Palestine from the river to the sea.
Thank you.
And that was another great Tobaya song choice. That was Sydney band Orion with Execution. We've got a very special bunch of guests in the studio.
Yeah, we have. We've got David Woods and Atlanta Peabody, who are coming to talk to us here about the Awkward Giraffes Festival of Critical Comedy, which is on next weekend. So, Atlanta, you can kick off. You've been involved.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Sophia's here as well.
Yes, I'm here too. We've got a lot of microphones available here, and we've got a whole team just been listening to some amazing music. Yeah, and Atlanta is normally interviewing people, so it's a joy to be actually interviewed. Turning the tables.
Okay, so what inspired the Awkward Giraffes Festival of Critical Comedy?
Well, I guess the whole thing was more or less instigated by Jeremy Dixon, and the whole notion of the Awkward Giraffe was about comedy that sticks its neck out like an awkward giraffe, right? And Eurydice Dixon was into thinky comedy, critical comedy, so it's trying to continue that legacy. And so hopefully pushing the boundaries of just not just some kind of crass, lowest common denominator kind of comedy, but broadening it a little and challenging audiences a little.
You mentioned Eurydice Dixon. I didn't realize the festival had a relationship with
Well, Jeremy is Eurydice's dad. Uh-huh. And Jeremy didn't necessarily see himself as an event organizer, and yet this is the third year of the Festival of Critical Comedy.
Uh-huh. What a great legacy.
Yeah, and David Woods was also part of the team last year presenting. Well, David's a fully qualified comedian, right? A highly qualified.
Mm-hmm. I'm probably the most qualified comedian in the world.
What are the KPIs for that?
The KPIs, I don't think you can go beyond a doctorate, and that's what I have. I have a comedy PhD.
Wow.
Supervised by the first comedy doctor, Oliver Double, at the University of Kent in Canterbury in England.
Did it make you funnier?
Well, I don't...
Or more boring.
exactly. comedy's like dissecting a frog. That question's a good one. At the time I was writing, I did feel very boring and unsurprising. But... looking at the intricacies and the sort of mechanics of comedy is quite an interesting exercise, I think, for anyone to do.
I loved your seminar last year, which was all about how to be funny.
That's right.
So
that
is there a formula?
Explained in great depth about it.
Well, no, there are many formulas, and, mm-hmm. and as with any kind of practice, there's a broad sort of range of types and styles. For example, tragedy plus time equals humor.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a particular brand of humor.
I do, yeah.
My
practice as a performer, as a theater artist mostly, took me into the comedy ranks, but from a sort of narrative, character-driven world with my double act partner, Jonathan Haynes, in a company called Ridiculousmas, which we've run now for 35 years, and it came out of sort of naturalistic drama that went badly wrong.
It's a little bit like the visualizations in Tintin.
Yeah, well, a lot of that goes badly wrong, doesn't it? So I've got my own particular shtick, but the work I was doing was looking at the major groups of humor theory about the mechanics of humor.
Because it's not just about what you do, it's about how the audience perceives it, right?
Yeah.
It's about cognitive processing as well and the perception of incongruity.
That's right.
And I believe, David, that you've been known to give soft tomatoes to audiences. Will that be happening this year?
to
gauge their response.
Just to double check, did you say soft tomatoes?
Yeah. I said tomatoes.
She's trying to bag
me. You say tomato. I say tomato.
Sorry, I mean soft tomato.
I say potato. Let's not call it off now.
I have been bagged on community radio in Melbourne several times, and here we go again. Yes.
But there are no tomatoes in the studio, so it's okay.
This time, what Atlanta is referring to is an early comedy club venture that I did with Jonathan, Dr. Jonathan Haynes. And it was called the Tomato Club. And it was run above a couscous restaurant in Kentish Town, London. And the audience were indeed issued trays of soft tomatoes, or at least as soft as we could get.
So they could throw them at you?
And they could throw them at us, yeah. And we had
I guess the joy of that is being near the restaurant,
not being the cleaner.
You got access to compost, right, so you can get rid of them afterwards.
We had tomato seeds dripping down the walls. We were honoured with visits from people like Jerry Sadovitz, which was, an interesting time in alternative comedy, before the sort of cancellation era, I guess. He was operating in that sort of provocative space where you weren't really sure whether you should be laughing with, against, because, or despite, what was going on.
Is this what's going to happen next weekend then?
No. Atlanta's just doing her digging.
Because I was going to ask you.
Well,
I was going to ask you. If someone's throwing tomatoes at you, do you get funnier?
Well, the idea is to be funny to survive.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I've been set on fire when I've been performing, by angry audiences.
Oh, my God.
I've been threatened with violence.
Wow. Really sticking your neck out,
I've never actually
right?
been punched by someone. I think Jerry Sadovitz was punched, talking of him, at the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival, when he said something like, moose fuckers, and the
Canadian took it the wrong way.
Couldn't take it, yeah. So,
is there a right way to take that?
Yeah.
Well, clearly there was the intention, really, if you think, how do you define comedy? It's something people laugh at, mm-hmm. But people laugh for many different reasons. And, certainly last year we were exploring that in quite a technical way with that show, How to Be
That's
Funny.
That's right. And also as it's critical comedy, it's not just to create laughter, maybe not just that belly laughing out loud, but also making people think, hoping to provoke discussion.
But you should
And think, they might have that internal debate within themselves, David, like you're talking about. They're not quite sure how to take it.
Yeah.
And it does make them think.
I mean, what about you, Sophia? What do you think?
Well, I've always enjoyed the festival, and I feel like we can have a wide range of things happening there. Sometimes there are new performers coming out, and Jeremy, in the first year, it was just like open slather. It wasn't exactly curated, and so it was just whoever put up their hand, and it's become a little more
like an open curated,
I guess so, a bit like that. Yeah, a little like that.
But you learn, don't you?
Excuse me, Atlanta, I'm talking.
Oh, yeah.
Atlanta always keeps butting in. But this year, and also there has traditionally been a comedy debate, but this year they're going to do a quiz show instead. I think there's still going to be some kind of audience participation with that as well. And if you're wondering what Atlanta Peabody's doing there, I think she's going to be I'm going to be doing like Vox Pop, interviewing people and going around and then writing reviews later
on. She's
good.
You might actually throw some our way.
Yeah, that's true.
Does anybody record it?
I don't know. I'll have my notebook there.
In the red leaf tablets of their heart, yes.
I'm doing some sketches.
Well, I always thought that, they do say that culture underpins politics and having a good belly laugh has always been the instrument of those dispossessed attacking dictators. So it's a perfect vehicle.
Weaponizing comedy like that, it's an interesting sort of strand of the whole. I thought actually that's maybe what we'd be talking about most of all today is like what are you using your humor for, rather than the sort of mechanics of who's doing this act or that act or whatever. But you think about what does the Melbourne Comedy Festival do? You go to an act there and you kind of come out having laughed maybe quite a lot and sort of like exercised your diaphragm somewhat and maybe your cheeks and tears and so on.
Yeah, which is, but that's not to be sneered at. It's like singing in a choir,
dispels so there's bad energy or something.
Yeah, there's that kind of therapeutic version of it. And as you know, that you can do laughter yoga where you don't even have any comedy. You just do that exercise in order to achieve the sort of state of calm post laughter. But laughter is very different to humour and comedy, because we're talking about what is the impulse, but also what's the intention. And very often I would go to a comedy show and I'd come out completely oblivious as to what that was all about. And I didn't care. I'd just done the exercise of laughing.
Laughing.
Actually, that's a quote from Dr. Richard Talbot, who has been in How to Be Funny with me, and he coined that phrase. So laughing, you know, we're thinking about what it is we're doing, which is, I think, the point of difference to a some more run-of-the-mill comedy festival.
Well, it's quite obvious that because it goes Saturday and Sunday, so we're talking Saturday the 29th of November from 1 p.m. to
11 or so.
10 p.m. Yeah. Well, it said officially 10 p.m. Yeah. And so it's a good slice, hefty slice.
Yeah, and then the Sunday.
And then Sunday.
Yeah.
From 1 to 9, so that you can do the bump out, no doubt, and you'd be exhausted. It means that people can come in and out of this affair. That's right.
They can do, and there'll be slotted shows. What else there'll be, David, when you're talking about those issues that you're talking about not just laughing for laughter's sake, but also even what you're saying about the weaponizing of comedy, it's very interesting. But Joe Toscano, who's also been involved since the beginning, adjudicating the debate, and I guess at this venue of the Unitarian Church, there's this element of anarchism. Apparently,
it's a great space.
Yeah, that's right. There was the great anarchist split of 1967 or 77. And actually, if it's going to be a hot weekend, we're hoping to offer those anarchist splits as a refreshing treat to our audiences. But David, there is going to be Joe Toscana's argument table from 2 to 6 p.m.
You can go and have an argument.
You don't just have to laugh. You can flesh it out. You can thrash it out with Joe at this argument table. So
there's
an opportunity for one-on-one debate there.
Also, it's free.
Yes, but you can donate. Donations are most welcome.
Very welcome.
And bookings, so we can get an idea of numbers.
Bookings, and also you can take a packed lunch.
Yeah, but I believe there's some catering.
There's a bar this year as well, and I know that because I'm the licensee holder and also the responsible service of alcohol.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's very
so there'll only be one pause in the service of refreshments, which is when I'm actually doing my show each day with Jonathan Haynes.
Okay, and the other thing is it's not just you. You're in company, aren't you? There's other people.
Greg Fleet's on the program.
Yeah, who's hilarious. I'll have to say, in real life, I mean, I've seen him many a time in the past as well as more recently, and he is very quick.
He is, and he's got a lot to offer just in the broader context of the life of a comedian and the things that can happen, things that can go wrong, the notion of a comedian's career, the ups and downs.
The cost of sacrificing yourself on the altar of audience mirth is writ large in Greg Fleet's blog.
And there's Sophie Prince with the apophenia. There's Pauline Sherlock. She's going to be part of the quiz show.
Doppelgangster.
Shirley Hawke, Doppelgangster with Kareth and Tobias.
Manderson Galvin. Yeah,
that's it. Look at that. We shared the saying of the name.
Performance artists.
We're in sync.
But very funny.
Liz Skitch, who's exploring the maelstrom of suburbia down the back of the couch with some comic poetry. So there's quite a range.
Oh, that's fantastic.
The work I'm doing this year is actually 10 classic psychology experiments performed on a clown. So we're revisiting the sort of canon of disturbing, unethical social psychology.
Yeah, like the electric.
Will you actually have a clown there that you're experimenting on?
Well, we're both in a way, and John would deny this, but I think many people would label us as clowns.
So you're experimenting on each other?
Yes, yes.
And live.
So yeah, live.
People need to go to this event. It's at the...
The Unitarian Peace Church, 110 Gray Street, East Melbourne.
Yeah,
you can't miss it. It's just behind the private consulting clinics, where people are sort of hanging around.
Yeah, and trams go past. You know, just a parallel universe to that.
You can get there easily. Sort of think patients could pop in for a bit of extra therapy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as we said, it's on the 29th and the 30th, and at 1 p.m. on Saturday to 10 and or 11, and Sunday the 30th from 1 29, so they can do the bump out. Thanks very much for coming in, you three.
Pleasure. Thank you for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks very much.
Headache.
Yeah, it's great.
Royal Headache from Sydney. Today we're only listening to locally Sydney. Grown music.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's great. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie.
Anila.
And Tabia.
And we're going to now go to the audio from the picnic on Victoria Parliament steps to commemorate the sacking of Whitlam government 50 years ago.
In the land of Terra Nullius, let's not forget that between 1788 and 1992, this country was based on the legal fiction of the Terra Nullius, the land of no one. Now, what we've seen since 1975 is a wholesale attempt by conservative and reactionary elements in the society, led by the Institute of, I call them Pride of Private Affairs, I can't bear myself to bring the word public with them, is to change the narrative. And what's disappointing about today, people remember it's the 50th anniversary of the dismissal of the Whitlam government, and people are still debating whether it was legal or not. But very few people are talking about the long-term reform agenda, which continues to have a significant impact on the lives of every Australian. Whether you access legal aid, a community health centre, use Medicare when you go to the doctor, access, well, we no longer have free education, thank you, Mr. Hawke and Mr. Keating. But the thing is that there's been wholesale rewriting of history, and it's seeped out into the general public as if the Whitlam-led Labor government, which was a government based on passing legislation to redistribute wealth, not maintain wealth in the hands of a minuscule minority, but redistribute wealth by bypassing state governments, funding local councils to do necessary work, introducing legislation, as we said, community health centres, community radio, free education, end conscription, recognise China, the list goes on and on and on. Environmental laws, laws regarding equality between men and women, equal pay. And you think, why is this government so much in, you know, it's as if it's a turd. It's a political turd when you speak to people in authority. Why is it a political turd? Because it threatened them, irrespective of whether we think we should have a bigger extra parliamentary movement. We don't have a bigger extra parliamentary movement. But what we saw, and this is important, what we saw is ordinary people getting together, demanding reform, and they did it through a political party. The Labor Party would not have embarked on that reform agenda without ordinary people joining that party, being involved in extra parliamentary activity, strikes. Remember, you could strike legally in those days. You could occupy without any, you know, consequences, and the list goes on and on. So why have they attempted to turn this government into the worst government in Australian history, when in reality, regarding its redistribution of wealth agenda, it was the most successful government in Australian history? Why? Because it challenged them. It did challenge them through the parliamentary system. And that's why they needed to be removed. So that's all I can say, is how history is rewritten every day to actually change the historical narrative. And it is done to a large degree to teach us that resistance is pointless. And resistance isn't pointless, as we've been told by most of the speakers today. And that's why we're here. We expected thousands, we've got a dozen.
Yeah, we had to keep on fighting. I thought at my age, at 74, I'd be able to have a bit of a rest. I became an activist when I was 16, when I went to an Aboriginal mission station with the Methodist Church to lend a hand. I was horrified. I saw young men sleeping on wire frames with no mattresses, concrete floors. It's still going on now. Look down here at this little thing on this, the traditional land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. We proudly acknowledge the First Nations people of Victoria, the traditional owners of all the lands from which the representatives of the people of Victoria meet in this parliament. Here at this place, their traditions and ceremonies will always be honoured. It's not true. What are they doing? This treaty, there's not even a treaty, if you listen to Robbie Thorpe. I'm angry and I'm getting angrier by with every birthday, and I'll continue. Thank you.
I want to briefly invoke the ghost of Monty Miller here, best remembered as an industrial workers of the world activist and fighter against conscription in World War One. What's less remembered is that he was also a pioneer of the Australian Labor Party. At the same time as being a direct actionist and seeing the need for a mass direct action movement, he also saw the use of parliamentary action. And he always knew what would happen with the Labor Party. He believed still that it was worth the candle pushing that line of endeavour separate from his work as a wobbly. I am gratified actually to see people like Joe, who's been I first met as a hardliner, you know, stay away from Parliament at all costs, taking on that it is more complex than that. And you can afford to be a pure direct actionist if somebody else is doing the parliamentary work. When you're actually rebuilding an effective movement for change, you've got to pay regard to the complexity of it. Okay, everyone's doing the personal experience. My first demonstrations and I think first arrests were in anti-Kerr. I was in university in the first place because Whitlam and the Labor government had made it free. My first arrests, my first demonstrations, my first time being thrown around with cops was in protesting the dismissal. I think we all understood on a gut level the whole gamut of the movement against the class system is important. The Labor Party at the moment is no longer that. We will see. We will see if that can be regenerated. I hope it can. My best wishes to all Labor Party activists who are trying to do that.
Somebody mentioned about conscription, and it reminded me of my brother, Matt, when I was about 11. He was conscripted into the army. He didn't want to go. He'd just finished his apprenticeship. He had a girlfriend. He had his life ahead of him. And he was forced to go into the army. And he was a driver. So after he'd been there for about a year, he had a best friend, Peter Trumbull. And one day he went with Peter to visit Peter's wife and his three-month-old baby. And Peter said, "I'm not going back." And my brother said, "You have to. If you don't, you'll be able, they'll lock you up." And he said, "How can I go and leave them?" My brother persuaded him, "You have to go and leave them." As he was driving back, his truck rolled over and Peter was killed. And I was horrified at the amount of power the government had over people to force them into employment that they didn't want to do. And, you know, ultimately, it was Peter's life. And I think that that influenced me when it came around to Whitlam and his policies. And after 18 months, my brother was pulled into a hall with all the other army people. And they were told, change of government, you're free, you can go, walk out. You don't have to do this anymore. And it was such a fantastic day. Yeah, so after 18 months, he would have had to do 3 years. But so that was a happy end to his story. So he got on with his life.
Yeah, look, I'm just thinking about that strike that I was involved in. It's amazing what a reformist government like the Whitlam government was can make ordinary workers feel that they have the power to do things. And I don't think I had any specific politics in mind. It was just some inchoate feeling that things had to change, that the wealthy had to be brought to account. We haven't seen a lot of that. But that when people stick together, when people stand together, they can affect, change and influence others to feel the same way.
Yeah, thank you, Gough Whitlam and the Labor government, with all the support you gave us back then, and also for the support, as in for the single mothers, and the other supports in the community that was very, very important at the time, and supporting public housing.
The Whitlam Labor government was the closest thing we've had to anything that resembles reform. Reform on a human level, reform on a socialist level, reform for all people, not just the select few, like we're seeing at the moment. Thank you.
Now, I'm interested in this concept that most people don't seem to grasp. It's only during a period of a reformist government that a radical strategy is able to be implemented. Because those of us who are old enough to remember the Whitlam government, we were young people in our early mid-20s, remember the rank and file groups within the trade union movements, the Sydney BLF in their direct democratic and agenda. Remember all the small groups that are involved, even things like the Collingwood Children's Farm accessing land that was vacant and using it for community use. And many of these things occur during a reformist period. The Russian Revolution didn't occur when the Tsar was in power. It occurred when the reformist government was in power. The changes that occurred in Spain during the Spanish Revolution, the radical changes occurred after the left-wing government, which was supported by the anarchists, socialists and communists, came into power. So when you have a reformist government in action, it gives the extra parliamentary movement extra breathing space. You don't have ASIO on your back. Remember that Mr. Murphy, the Attorney General, raided ASIO because at that particular point in time, Croatian nationalists were creating havoc in Melbourne and Sydney by bombing targets. And it was obvious that ASIO was not interested in that because they were part of the anti-communist front, which they had supported for 27 years. So what I'm saying is there is a reason to support reform. Revolution doesn't come, as a lot of people think, from abject poverty. abject poverty creates a mentality where you're honed in on survival.
Yep.
And I learned that on these steps in 2016, when we were here 24 hours a day for 10 days, because I had to think about where I'm going to have a piss, where I'm going to have a shit, how am I going to keep warm, how am I going to keep the rain off, and these were these day-to-day things. When people say to me, why aren't the homeless involved in the struggle for public housing? Because they're involved in the struggle for survival. So what I'm saying is, reformist governments give the opportunity for radical action.
Awkward Giraffe presents the Festival of Critical Comedy 2025 on the weekend of the 29th and 30th of November, 2 p.m. to 8 at the Melbourne Unitarian Peace Church, 110 Grey Street, East Melbourne. Awkward Giraffe promotes comedy to make you think. Lineup includes comedy legends Greg Fleet and Nick Sun, and the groundbreaking Ridiculousness and Doppelgangster, and much more. Free entry. For more details, see awkwardgiraffe.net. Awkward Giraffe proudly supports 3CR.
A weak solidarity Bricky team listener, when a state treaty with Terra Nullius non-land non-people and a body to be consulted on matters affecting Terra Nullius non-land non-people got off to a roaring start as the very day they signed the treaty, they simultaneously announced children would receive minor penalties like life imprisonment. So obviously the locking up children appease Lord Rupert of Wapping and that hotbed of commie working class, police association legislation, will have nothing to do with Terra Nullius non-land, non-people children. So much for consultation. Not totally unrelated and not telling us anything we didn't know, I'm sure none of us missed the irony within days of the New South Wales, police getting stuck into people opposing the merchants of death and calling for peace, not trained killing. Dangerous, dangerous peace activists and granting a permit for a Nazi rally outside Parliament, not getting stuck into, indeed condoning, those whose objective strategy is violence, not dangerous, violent Nazis. Interesting how the coppers seem to save their most violent attacks for those protesting at merchants of death exhibitions who boast their capacity to slaughter and destroy, including, as usual, Zion merchants of death, supported morally and financially by our socialists, Zion merchants of death whose merchandise goes on proving its exciting killing machinery in the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation of the non-land, non-people, illegally occupying Zion land in Gaza and the West Bank, Zion land from the river to the sea. Even more exciting, one of those merchants of Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, Advanced, isn't that wonderful, is negotiating to flog its Iron Dome missile defense system to True Blue Aussie. With UNSW trained killing expert Jennifer Parker, Jennifer, a former trained killer herself, is turning up increasingly to comment on matters of trained killing, said investing in missile defense is a number one priority for the government. Forget health, forget education, forget transport, housing, the poorest of the poor, the environment, all irrelevant. Our number one priority is to pour billions into the Zion economy, allowing this bastion of liberty, freedom and democracy to continue to protect itself through slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation of the people, illegally occupying little bits of the land from the river to the sea, given to Zion by Yahweh 3,000 years ago. And it gets better. Rolls in Wealth Royce, purveyor of obscenely expensive exhaust pipe polluters to the filthiest rich of the filthy rich, now makes even more obscene profits as a merchant of death. And here's the gets better bit. Right here in Victoria, the socialists have signed a memorandum of understanding with Rolls in to develop homegrown nuclear talent to maintain AUKUS train killing underwater thingies and new tech centres and collaborations with our universities, extending the exciting conversion of tertiary education into centres of train killing propaganda. the excitement goes on and on. Also this week, big Supremo Anthony Albanese signed a train killer agreement with Indonesia and other people's business Supremo. In the same week, the Supremo, a war criminal himself in Timor-Leste, declared former butcher Nohato a national hero, presumably for slaughtering millions of people. Good one, Anthony, and top marks for being diplomatic enough not to raise the national hero status of the mass murderer of anyone remotely left. The Net Zero intelligence spread this week to their caring business class party coalition partner, with the so-called conservatives, well, they are, marching in a political phalanx in one of the more extreme examples of political puerility, marching toward oblivion and making the socialist pro-fossil policies look positively radical. I use so-called conservatives because when we look at the so-called moderates, it's all relative, just various extremes of conservative. As a by the by on their political puerility, many, many years ago, 1970 in fact, on the old ALP executive, then ACTU advocate Bob Hawke called me puerile and juvenile. And closing the debate on the motion I'd moved, I retorted brilliantly, "That's tautological." That was 3 days before we were sacked by the federal executive with the fingers of Gough Whitlam all over it. Which brings us to another event this week. What most commentaries, and there was no shortage of them, failed to mention through the myriad of what-ifs was, what if, speaking of arch-conservatives, Queensland Supremo Joe Belchy-Peterson and New South Wales caring business class party then Supremo Tom Lewis had observed the convention that Senate vacancies be filled by someone from the same party. After Queenslander Bert Milner died and Lionel Murphy went to the High Court, they appointed anti-Labor conservatives, whereas if they hadn't been rats in the grand scheme, the coalition could not have blocked supply. As a result, the convention was later passed into law to ensure it couldn't happen again. And the grand scheme, the US of the UN of the US of the world through its Ambassador Marshall Green, whereby pure chance coups occurred in every country to which he was appointed, had its fingers all over that one as well. Lord Rupert's pay for no facts lie news ran a special on the dismissal, and sorry I missed it, because it would have been nothing but truth, balance and objectivity. Back to the Nat Zero intelligence, caring business class party Supremo and would-be big Supremo for the time being, Suss and Lees and Dregs, said by exporting massive amounts of gas, of LNG, all over the world, True Blue Aussie was contributing to other countries' decarbonisation. Huh? Maybe someone should remind Sussan that gas Sussan, just happens to be a fossil fuel. But it's okay, because we don't count those other countries' emissions as part of our pollution footprint. The ambassador from one of those other countries, Japan, this week urged Anthony to spend lots of public money to incentivize carbon capture and storage, that head-in-the-sand panacea allowing the fossils to pollute to their big heart's content. Yes, you buy huge amounts of our gas, and the best is we make huge profits on selling it to other countries. We've mentioned many times, and listener, we're sadly forced to mention again, the innate selfishness of lazy, avaricious workers crippling the economy, borne out by figures this week showing too many selfish workers are working. There's not enough unemployed, an essential requirement for the Reserve Losses Bank to cut interest rates. Disgraceful. But congratulations and a big thank you to the too few who are unemployed for doing their bit for the greatest little economic order of them all. And we're sure you're having a great time whooping it up on your fabulous unemployment benefits. No connection, but a survey shows 47% of people in the city of Melbourne reported food insecurity. Just under 20%, well, 19.3%, saying there were times in the past year when they'd ran out of food and couldn't afford to buy any. The Council of Social Services fingered the problem, something we would never have thought of. Poverty. Go on. Melbourne ran sixth, by the way, with Casey, Hume, Wyndham, Whittlesea, Brimbank and Greater Geelong the highest levels. But good news, the number of filthiest rich of the filthy rich rose 10%, 70,000 joining their ranks. Surely as the poorest of starve, they can console themselves with that thought. And the federal court has to be condemned for aiding and abetting the selfishness of workers who work, fining the big Aussie, BHP, for bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, and ordering it to pay $84,000 to workers it forced to work on Christmas Day, depriving them of time with family and of those with whom they'd rather spend the day, the court said, ruling workers must have a choice. Quite properly, bloody huge said the compensation was grossly unfair because the workers had been paid penalty rates for the work they were forced to do. What was the court thinking of? Notice arch-conservative shock jock John Laws unto himself and, quote, Labour power broker Graham Dickhead's son died this week. Good, no, but hang on. They say don't speak ill of the dead, so we'll let that one slide. In the apropos of nothing department, have to confess my cultural life is seriously lacking, as I have never seen these ubiquitous Kardashian-Richians, what they do other than being famous for being famous as they see it, but I've always considered them deep thinkers, proven when Kim Kardashian announced way back in 2019 she was studying law. Well, this week she yet again took the final exam to get a law degree and yet again failed. But she's going to keep going, she said. If she ever passes, pity help her clients. Couple of related finalies. The socialists have been trying to wean themselves off ultra-expensive consultants they inherited from the coalition, appointing public servants to do what public servants are supposed to do. But now the caring business class is complaining at the amount spent on public service salaries. Money that should be spent on consultants, on Zion merchants of death, and on incentivising the head-in-the-sand solution to climate change, if there is such a thing. While, finally, the state socialists are seeking ways of saving billions, mainly by sacking, or sorry, sadly having to let go, lots of public servants, and in their case, have spent millions on consultants to tell them how to save money, which means we can immediately tell them how they can save millions. Good morning.
Good morning, Kevin. This is Annie on 3CR Solidarity Breakfast, and I'm in company with Tabia and Anila. And in the studio, we've got Amelia, and we've got Dusty on the phone. Now, Dusty and Amelia are rank and file CFMEU, Vic Construction in general, and we wanted to get an update, a bit of perspective following the push by the administration to remove up to 15 of the existing 30 organisers. G'day, Amelia. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. How are you guys?
Yep. And what about you, Dusty?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. How are you guys?
Good. Now, Dusty, you're a delegate, so you went to the most recent delegate meeting after the removal of Steve Long and the threat of removing more organisers. What was the general feel of the meeting?
The meeting was a bit sombre because we'd had a few deaths in our membership. So it sort of led with that. And then there was a bit of a report back on Steve Long. So you would have seen some articles and stuff come out. A lot of innuendo, a lot of speculation and trying to essentially say that Steve Long's done something wrong by having the CFMU donate money to a local community sports club, which every building union and a bunch of corporate sponsors sponsor as well. It's also not the only football club that we sponsor. You know, I believe there's four others all the way down to Hastings. So they've tried to tie him as if he's done something wrong in there. And then mention some companies. One's got a ATO tax bill. I don't know how that's got anything to do with the CFMU. I think it's a government should chase up their own money. And then one, that's a sponsor to the club. And, they were an EBA company, one that we never wanted. I believe they got it through the MBA, not through our office. So that's the master builders issue there, that they've given that company an EBA as far as I'm concerned. Steve Long's been with the union for 50 years, and 20 of those years he's been a union official working for the union.
Amelia, have you been, how are other people at your work site and in general been feeling about the attacks in The Age that have not led to any charges, but there are a lot of, as Dusty said, lots of innuendo?
I mean, to be honest, at my workplace, I don't think that any of my colleagues pay much attention to The Age and whatever rubbish they're putting out. For my comrades who are a bit more involved with the union and who attend branch meetings and who have been paying close attention to this administration, we're really concerned because this legislation that put us into administration came out of a big media attack. And we keep seeing waves of mainstream media just coming on to attack our union. So although, like, most of these claims are unsubstantiated and, like, really grasping at straws, really trying to pick at anything that they can, it turns into real consequences with the administration. So, like, when the legislation was passed and we were put under administration, we lost 270 officials in one day. And then as it's progressed, as more media reports come out, the administrator will retaliate and remove more officials. And we're not seeing officials removed for allegations of corruption or wrongdoing. We actually see a lot of officials removed for political reasons, or because they rub the administrator up the wrong way. So one official that was removed last year was Esther. She was removed after having a confrontation with Nick McKenzie in public.
A journalist who's been...
Yes.
Well, if you can call him that.
Well, whatever, yeah.
Yeah. And Nick McKenzie just called up the administrator and within 24 hours she was removed. There was no investigation. There's no right of reply. And at the moment, we're waiting to have Esther's case heard in the courts. She's challenging this dismissal and this move to put her on the removed persons list. So we're fully behind her and we want her back in her position. We also only a few months ago saw another round of officials being forced out. So not all of these officials are sacked and put on the removed persons list. There are a number of officials who are forced to resign.
Yeah, that's what they say. They say to them, you either resign or we're going to, you'll lose all your, you know, entitlements and stuff like that.
Exactly, which doesn't really give them much of a choice.
I mean, they're out class anyway.
People. Yeah, exactly. They've got families to look after. They've got homes to keep over their heads and everything like that. And like... some of the officials early on who were forced to resign, they were forced to sign NDAs and all that kind of rubbish and then were put on the removed persons list anyway. And
the removed persons list means they're not allowed to apply for any work in the union, in any union.
Yeah, any union, and they can't represent workers in any capacity. So it's really pretty serious. Like in Queensland, we've seen them lose 50% of their officials, and same with South Australia. And then in New South Wales, they've lost over 70% of their officials. And so now this new round of stripping out people from our union is really concerning because we're losing a lot of experience and a lot of really great people who fight for their members. And yeah, it's kind of like, well, what are we going to be left with? It's just a bit over a year of administration and we've already lost so much.
Yeah, well, Dusty, bring you in here. The thing that The CFMEU is a membership organisation, and it's organised around a top tier. Then you've got your organisers, then you've got your delegates, then you've got your members. And this allows people from on the shop floor to be able to report through if there's any issues that need to be dealt with, especially safety, because, of course, construction is a very dangerous industry. What are the fears of removing all that experience by getting rid of another 15 organisers?
Yeah, there's a massive fear of that happening. I mean, just like what you've said, we would lose decades and decades of knowledge and experience, relationships with other unions and, the builders and people that we deal with to ensure that our jobs are safe and our members are looked after, and there's always representation. So to remove, any more senior officials, Longy was, very much a senior official with his time with the union. So, taking those sort of heads out of the game will definitely damage us. And it's those type of relationships that are built up over years and years that keep our jobs safe, that keep delegates and HSRs on the job and making sure that there's representation and that workers get a fair say in what happens on the job and how they're protected, how their safety is managed and things like that. So I think it will be a massive, massive loss and damage to our union and every single member that's out there.
This is a foundational thing that that unions do, but also any community organisations, they function on trust. And the way that the state attacks all these political organisations, whether it's a union or it's a community organisation, you can look at the history from the American COINTELPRO program, they divide and conquer by using trust as the main weapon. So what Nick McKenzie's been doing is sowing these seeds of mistrust for everyone. And really, the antidote is for us to all rally around and support the CFMEU now more than ever. I mean, I was on the phone this year collecting the donation that the Port Melbourne Club gave to 3CR as part of the CFMEU's drive. So that's really shows how these trust links are built.
Yeah, 100%. And Longy's definitely a community type person. He's a major lover of 3CR. He does his show on the Sundays. That's a bit of a CFMEU type show to talk about our industry and everything. So, I think you start to lose that connection to community as well once you take out those sort of senior people that have been building it up for years and years.
I'd love to hear from both of you about your thoughts about the motives behind completely undermining different CFMEU branches' capacity to organise for their workers.
I think that really these attacks are not going to stop until the builders and the bosses say, okay, we're satisfied. The CFMEU has a reputation for really being quite staunch in maintaining health and safety conditions and pulling up builders when they're doing the wrong thing.
Even working in the rain or in that wild wet wind that we had recently.
Exactly. Our union is constantly pushing for more changes in our industry and improving our industry for the workers. But I think that the bosses and the builders see that as coming as a cost to them. But not only that, I think that the Labor Party have a real interest in seeing the dismantling of the CFMEU. I think that before administration, the CFMEU was building a lot of political power in the Labor Party, and that was a real threat to them.
What about you, Dusty?
Yeah, I totally agree with Amelia. We made a commitment that we wanted to start politically organising, and so we started to join to try and get a more fair say in how it goes and build up some campaigns and stuff. So you would have seen one of our more recent campaigns to get engineered stone banned to protect workers from silica and getting silicosis and things like that. So that's why we decided to try and move things faster. We need to be somewhat political as well. And then obviously the Labor Party and certain factions and maybe other unions themselves, unfortunately, have seen that as a bit of a threat. Builders have always been knocking on the door of any political party to go after us. You know, just when this sort of happened, we were about 5 to 6 months out of ABCC being abolished. You know, the Australian Building Construction Commission. And we just got that boot off of our neck. And then the Labor Party decided, no, we're going to have to do something much, much drastic. And so the Coalition and the ALP have teamed up and rushed through this legislation that, it is very draconian. It's absolutely disgusting. It leaves almost no rights to all union employees and even members themselves. So it's been rushed through. It's a way to attack us. It's a way to stymie us. And next year, we'll start to revisit our next EBA. And I really, really do think the builders are going to start really pushing back and want to fight. And you may see some industrial disputes, legal protected industrial action take place for the first time in a lot of years.
Okay, all right. We have to wind up. And I guess this is a watching brief. And hopefully we'll have you guys back and you can give us an update.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to be here.
And no worries. Thank you very much for having us on.
Yeah, and good luck. You guys. That's the end of the show. And coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. And what's the track?
We're going to go out with No Cops in Heaven by Split System, another local band.
It's the sale of...
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.